to get better. If we kept acting rational and sane, now I can see the clouds on the horizon. Bad times are coming round again. The sun, it ripens corn across the country, and shares are rising on the stock exchange.
Welcome to Cow Dust and Cattle Country. I'm your host, Laura. Today we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to read a chapter of a locally historic published book so that we can become more familiar with the ranching and timber and mining of our historic past. If it goes over well, maybe we'll read the whole book. First, a quick PSA. Please check out RanchersHaveRights.com, a website by Carolyn Nelson. If you have questions about how grazing allotments became prevalent in the area and across the West, her website is the place to go. Black Range Tales, 60 Years of Life and Adventure in the Southwest, James A. McKenna. If you haven't read it, you really should. Mandy Lou. The Rawhiders Come to New Mexico. In the year 1888, I was a prospector and miner at Lake Valley in Sierra County, New Mexico. The silver mines here were famous for their rich deposits, most of which were found close to the surface. One of them had produced over $3 million from what was known as the Bridal Chamber. Its greatest depth was not over 40 feet. The shape of the deposit gave it the name. The mines and the town of Lake Valley lay on the northern edge of the Great Mesa, or plain, that extends south into Mexico. From all directions, at an immense distance on this plain, could be seen an extinct volcano, which from its shape was called by the Americans Hat Mountain, and by the Mexicans Sierra Sombrero. It was about 4 miles southeast of town, not far from the old Butterfield Road. After the mine was discovered, travelers along the road generally visited the camp, often locating in it. Grass and water were plentiful, but there was no sign of tree or brush within miles of the camp. The first large deposits had been taken from the mine, and in order to open others, the mining company offered leases. The terms were such that both new and old work was done for almost nothing by the leasers. Some new and rich deposits were opened up by the lucky ones among them. The papers, however, were so drawn up that if a leaser found one of the rich bodies of ore, he was allowed only 30 days to work it. Even at that, some managed to clean up $50,000. Some of those who made the biggest stakes were goat herders and cowboys who did not know beans from buffaloes in the mining game. One part of the mine was known as Goat Herder's Heaven, or the Nugget Ground. The formation here was the soft limestone containing large cracks and vugs. These cracks were filled with red clay. Scattered throughout this clay were boulders and chunks of ore, assaying from 100 to 500 ounces per ton. This was the section which became, by lease, the happy hunting ground of sheep herders and rawhiders. The rawhiders got their name from the many uses they had for cowhide. Cattle were plentiful and cheap in those days. When about to emigrate, and even before settling out on a long hunting trip, the rawhiders usually killed 3 or 4 large steers, not for food, but for hides. The dried hides were stored in their wagon beds and supplied 101 needs. If they had a breakdown, they soaked the hide and cut it into long strips called wangs, which they wrapped around the broken hub or wheel or tongue. As the wang dried, the edges of the break drew together. I have seen chairs, camp stools, wheelbarrows, and buckets made from hide. Since nails were hard to get, upright poles around their corrals were fastened with strips of rawhide. Their oxen were shod with it, and the zapatas, or shoes, they wore were usually made from leftover pieces. I'll venture to say that most of the old-timers' corrals in West Texas are still held together by thongs of rawhide. All rawhiders came from West Texas years before farming and drilling for oil became common there. They were on the move nearly all the time, driving their horses and cattle with them, also numerous large cur or mongrel dogs. The families traveled in covered wagons, which overflowed with women and children. They were all kinfolk, continually marrying and intermarrying. Grandpas and grandmas and babies at the breast were huddled together in almost every wagon. They never carried tents, but they were always a few extra wagon sheets. Everyone over 10 used snuff. The rawhider generally looked as if he had a billiard ball under his jaw, and the roll of pigtail was never long out of sight. This was a dry, twisted roll of natural leaf. When they ran out of tobacco, the wagon wheels stopped turning. All waited until a John Wesley or a Thomas Jefferson got back with a fresh supply. Sometimes this meant a 100-mile trip to the nearest government sutler. Rawhide outfits were usually made up of 10 or 15 wagons strung out for miles. They made it a point, however, to drift together before sundown. One saw pinto horses, scraggly cattle, and white-haired youngsters whose heads looked as if they had not been washed or combed for months. All the wagons were either Baines or Shetlers, and many a child was born in them. Sometimes a widow joined the caravan with a brood of children, but as a rule she did not stay single long. It was against the Rawhider's creed. Increase and multiply was their maxim. Popular wedding gifts were heifers, sows, and fillies, and pullets. Divorces were common. Cast-off wife or husband often stayed in the same outfit with the ex-spouse, perhaps marrying the former husband's brother or his first wife's sister. Like gypsies, they were ever on the move, sometimes halting, but never staying long anywhere. Even if they found plenty of water or a fine range with good grass, they were genuine squatters, and if some pilgrim came along and offered them a few cattle or a little cash, they pulled up stakes and migrated the next day, without a thought to their future. Their food was mostly beef, no matter whose. They never ate their own, claiming that the JXT or the XLCs had a sweeter taste. I lived amongst them for years. I never saw a piece of roast beef, except at a barbecue or a big feast. All meat was boiled or fried. Sometimes they cooked wild greens with the boiled meat. They usually used suet for frying and cooked everything else to a frazzle. Coffee was drunk as black as soot and so strong it could float a bottle. Biscuits raised with soda or cream of tartar were apt to be the color of an orange. Some of the women could cook very well when settled in a shack or a cabin, but the younger element, who never took a bath or combed their hair, did not know how to boil water. Who were these people and where did they come from? This has always been a mystery to the other texts. It is believed they came from a mountain district of Tennessee or North Carolina. Their Scotch-Irish names suggested this. In the mountain cabins of these states, one may still find chairs and buckets and hoops and rugs made of rawhide. They lived there by fishing and hunting and trapping. Pelts and roots were traded off for flour and sugar and tobacco. Slavery was unknown among them, and they were looked upon by slaveholders as white trash. When the Civil War started, the South tried to conscript them. They either joined the Northern troops or came west to the new lands. Cotton raising did not appeal to them, and they drifted to further western lands. They found game abundant and plenty of wild horses and thousands of unbranded cattle. Soon they were joined in this land of milk and honey by many of their kinsfolk. When the Civil War ended, many former slave owners also came out to the western lands. They were a wide awake set of people. Good houses and corrals appeared here and there in the wilderness. Immense herds of wild cattle were branded. The fat ones were driven to the railroad and sold at eastern markets. The Rawhiders woke up, and many of them also took up ranges and branded wild mavericks. But the roving fever was still there. Selling often and always moving further west, they at last reached the banks of the Rio Grande. A spring or water seepage often invited settlement, but they never built and went on cooking outside. Never in a hurry, they sometimes stayed for months in a wild grassy valley. No one knew who was president. In fact, they never voted. But without schools or newspapers, there was nothing to interest them except cattle, tobacco, and horse or pony racing. Most of them could neither read nor write, but they could beat the devil himself at swapping. Owners were always trading wagons. The women even blamed certain makes of wagons for carrying certain diseases. One mother said, "My Georgie Ann is much healthier than Ollie. You know, Mrs. Allison, my Georgie Ann was born in a Shetler. My Zeke traded it for a Studebaker and Ike Johnson. That wagon is sure great for every epidemic or itch or measles that came along. Then Zeke traded the Studebaker for a Bane, and my kids got the mumps in that wagon. Give me a Shetler any day for healthy kids, Arabella." As soon as the boys could walk, they were roping old Lidge, the dog, or Grandpa. As for roping or branding cattle, the Rawhider or border Mexican cowboy could do more with a lariat than any other roper in the world. Most of the boys' legs were so bowed that you could throw a barrel between them. In fact, if they went to the spring for water or chopped a little wood, they did it on horseback. Some of them could hardly walk. Their highest ambition was to own a broncho, a riding saddle, a pair of spurs, and a quirt. Oh, what biblical names they had! Ike, Zeke, and Luke among the boys, while the girls had such names as Patience and Prudence, Ruth or Martha. But in every family, if they had one or two children, would be found a John, a Wesley, or an Arabella, or both. They married very young, and before they reached the age of 25, they were often fathers and mothers to five or six children. A few became rich, taking up ranches and settling down. The later generations who went to school were smart and rather good-looking. Probably it was having to wash and comb their hair that made the difference. There certainly was a crowd of them with hair of fiery red. A marriage among them was a great event, the dancing and the festivities sometimes lasting for a week. They were experts at getting around the law. No rawhider was ever found guilty of cattle stealing in a Texas court. They could name every brand from the Del Rio to Tucson, and most of them knew the owners and the number of head they had on the range. Some of the women were as handy as the menfolk with a rope and branding irons. One and all had a marvelous gift for sighting a maverick and an unbranded calf. They were born cattlemen, but God helped the pilgrim who was located near them. The rawhider, like the buffalo and the Indian, belongs to the past. Wire fences, autos, nesters, and cattle associations put an end to his wandering. 2. The Rawhider's Restaurant. During the month of April 1888, a number of rawhiders came to the Lake Valley camp. The mining company gave leases to several of them on a part of the goat herder's haven. Credit was allowed them for a small supply of groceries and a few tools. The mine foreman gave them some instructions and saw that they worked. The company sampled and shipped all ores and also handled the returns. After taking out costs, royalty, and standing bills, the company paid the lease or what was left, which was often little enough. In a short time, however, two of the rawhiders struck a good body of ore, cleaning up $10,000. They or their comrades must have heliographed the news to their friends in West Texas. By August, a long string of covered wagons could be seen every day on the old Butterfield Road. Most of them came from Tom Green Country or the Concho section of Texas. About 2 miles west of the silver mines at Crystal Springs, they made their camp. Other miners and leasers were already living there. That fall and summer were very hot and dry. The Chinaman who ran the only eating house in camp pulled out for a cooler climate, giving this reason, "Too damn hot for me cookie." As a result, many of the miners had to batch it or else look up another camp for board or lodging. The merchant who owned the restaurant offered it rent-free for a year to anyone who would run it, as it meant money in his pocket, as well as a place to eat for the miners. Some of the miners put ads in the El Paso and San Antonio and Los Angeles papers offering a cook $75 a month and room and board, but they got no answer. Along in September, there arrived a new rawhide outfit from the Pecos section, numbering about 15 men, 20 women and children, and dogs aplenty. As the mining company was doing considerable building, they needed common laborers. When some of this crowd asked for work, the foreman ordered them to pull off their spurs and high-heeled boots and he would give them a tryout. Since they were badly in need of food, they gave in. At first, they handled the pick and shovel as if it were about to lasso a steer. But in time, led on by cuss words of the bosses, they became fairly good hands. On no account would they work underground, as they had come to the conclusion to stay where they could see the sun. Amongst them was a rather good-looking young woman of 20. Her name was Annabelle, the mother of a 3-year-old Mandy Lou, whose father was supposed to be taking care of a piece of ground in Texas. The miners, knowing the habits of this kind for gunplay, had a good laugh about that, saying the piece he was taking care of must be 6 feet underground. Annabelle was kin to everyone in the outfit and was always visiting from one wagon to another. She was never seen at work, but everyone in town came to know her poke bonnet and the thin gloves that reached her elbows. She used snuff and the stick very freely. Some of the young miners who took her to the dance gave out that she was a red-hot tamale, and some doer of the bunny hug and the bear shuffle, and could throw her hoofs to the queen's taste. I think that means she danced. This was a woman who finally took over the restaurant, and she told the committee that she had never done much cooking and asked for a few days to think it over. The outfit got her to take up the offer so they could get a hold of some badly needed cash, and several old grandmas promised to help her. She at last agreed to try it for a month. 10 miners signed up for $30 each. With no rent, cheap help, and low-cost food, this should have made it easy to set a table in the best of the market. But Annabelle seemed to have made up her mind to stick to rawhide dishes with a few exceptions. It was plain she had never seen a range and said she would rather cook on a tripod. She never cleaned the stove, and before long the dirty dishes had virtually climbed to the ceiling. For the first few days, the boarders said nothing, being satisfied with a change and hoping that she would get the knack. Among the boarders were two Germans. In order to get rid of it, the store clerks told her these men liked sauerkraut. I am sure she had never eaten or heard of it, but the store delivered her a barrel full. She served it raw, just as she took it from the barrel, brine and all. This took for a few times, and when it was put on the table at every meal, there were a few wry faces. At the end of the week, some very sarcastic remarks were going around the... On Sunday, one of the grandmas gave us a boiled pork dinner with white biscuits. The miners brightened up. By the end of the week, it was again kraut, bully beef, ginger snaps, and coffee that looked like ink. Once in a while, we had fried eggs for breakfast, but they always looked as if they had been dragged over the floor. Oh, what disgusted boarders we were. Some paid up and went back to batching. The restaurant soon became a regular rawhide headquarters. The women gathering there every afternoon all sat around the range on which they lined up their snuff bottles. Having filled their mouths with snuff, they made a game of squirting the juice at a knothole in the floor 10 feet away, hitting it dead center every time. Then they gossiped and never cleaned a dish or cooked a bite until the men were sighted coming home from work. A quick fire would then be built and the coffee pot set on the range, and presto, supper was ready. Mandy Lou never had much care, but after her mother took over the cooking, she was virtually forgotten. She always wore the same dress, and I am sure the poor child would not have known herself with a bonnet or shoes. She was a chubby little thing with big blue eyes and very light hair. Her face was dirty and her hair was tangled, but on account of her good-natured ways, she became a general favorite in the camps. Whenever an owner missed his dog, he learned to look for it near the restaurant, where he usually found it tumbling in the dust with Mandy Lure chasing sticks for her. Annabelle herself seemed to have but one dress. Some of the boarders named her Madame Few Clothes. She had no star boarder. All longed for the month to come to an end. The third week, on a Sunday night, some hung a muslin strip at the front porch with large black letters on it reading, Ginger Hotel, Rawhide Headquarters, Snappy Service, Kraut and Bully Beef 3 times a day. A.B. Few Clothes, Proprietress, Tom Green, Painter. Next morning, the sign could be seen from the stores and saloons. All the miners had read it. It was perhaps 10 o'clock before Annabelle heard about it through some of the grandmas, and her dander was up, and she threatened to leave at once. Only her fear of losing the pay that was coming to her kept her from doing so. She had her revenge otherwise. Things went from bad to worse in the kitchen. Finally, two of the grandmas came each day to cook the dinner, which was pretty good. At first, they cooked enough for supper, too. But when they found out that the afternoon gossipers had made away with all the leftovers, they got dinner only. One of these grandmas made Annabelle a new dress, and the old one, which had furnished the town talk for so long, was seen no more. She would sit for hours at a time, rubbing snuff, twirling her thumbs round and round, and taking no interest whatever in the house and boarders. Poor little Mandy Lou was lost half the time. Her mother said that she was like her father, always straying. She was usually found asleep in a cupboard or under a bed. It had been well proven by this time that it was bad business to hire a cook on her merits as a dancer. 3. The Wild Burros and the Lost Rawhide Child. The last Sunday of that long month of October had arrived. Most of the miners quit at 3 o'clock Saturdays, but my partner and I had stayed later than usual at the mine to sample s'mores. When we went to the restaurant about sundown, we found no one there. Looking up the street, we saw men and women running in every direction. Annabelle's brother told us that Mandy Lou had not been seen for some time, and they were afraid she had strayed up to the mine and fallen down a prospect hole. After a hasty supper of bacon and eggs, which we hustled together for ourselves, we again made for the street. We met a number of miners on their way to drink a few bottles of beer and play a game of auction pitch. One of them thought he had seen the child playing with Nolan's burros. These burros watered at one of the mine troughs, and it was feared that she had followed them up there. Nolan came into the saloon shortly afterward. He said that he had not seen the child when he watered the burros at 4 o'clock. but that he had taken note of a large stray jack with the herd, which was made up of 3 jacks, 4 jennies, and 2 colts. He said that they were in the habit of grazing at the south end of Hat Mountain, about 4 miles southeast of town. Just then Annabelle rushed up screeching, "Oh God, I know she is kidnapped. A gypsy told me I would lose my child by a colored person." The miners tried to quiet her, but she hardly listened. By this time the sun was down. Already the air was chilling and a new moon was rising in the east. The whole town was full of excitement. Searchers had found the small footprints of a child among those of the burros in front of the restaurant. Cowboys who rode out of the gulch about a mile west of town found many burro tracks but did not sight the herd. About 1/4 of the way to the gulch was a large frame house. In this lonely spot with her 4 children lived a woman known only as Annie. She made a living for herself and her children by washing and baking and doing chores for the mine bosses and their families. She never mixed with the other Texans, although it's said she came from Fort Worth. From the moment they got there, the rawhiders seemed to have it in for her. When they came back from the gulch, the cowboys said they had seen Annie going into her house with a large clothes basket as they galloped by. When the moon went down, all of the searchers returned to town. They came to the conclusion that the burros had either found shelter behind a rock or covered themselves with sand, for no one had caught sight or a glimpse of them. This was probable, as the nights were very cold in those parts, even in midsummer. Most of the searchers went home to their cabins, promising to be up at daybreak to help find the child. Some few still hung around, trying to figure things out. John Robinson, who had just arrived from town, gave them one more clue to work on. While herding his cattle on the Macho that day, he had sighted a pair of lobos, or timber wolves. The animals were eating a large calf when he rode up on the south end of the Sierra Sombrero. They had run off toward the Rio Grande. He believed they had come down from the Black Range, seeking a lower altitude for the winter. He had hardly stopped speaking when the crowd about him was startled by some mournful howls coming from that direction of the big gulch. Some of the men went as white as a sheet, and the women began to cry. Meanwhile, the rawhiders all gathered at the restaurant, motioning and swearing in loud voices. The women seemed to be after the men and kept pointing toward the woman's house. Someone asked me to go over there and see what the trouble was all about. On the way, I met Annabelle's father and asked him what was the cause of the rumpus. He told me that the women folks, also some of the men, believed that the woman was a voodoo doctress and that she had killed the child for her white blood. They'd come to the conclusion to go to the house to torture her and to make her tell where she had put the child's body. "Have any of you people talked to her?" I asked him. "No," was the answer. I said to him, "You people must not harm Annie until you have more evidence, as we prospectors and miners don't believe in such bunk, and we won't stand for any nonsense." On my way back to the saloon, I met Mr. Hadley, the superintendent of the mine, who had already been visited by an excited rawhider, sending trouble and perhaps a killing, because he knew the miners would not stand for any injustice to Annie. He rushed into town. "We'll go out to Annie's house and make a search," he told the miners, explaining to the rawhiders, "Myself and Jimmy here, we will take the lead, and you fellas stay in the rear." There was no light at her house. She called out in answer to Mr. Hadley's knock and told us we would have to wait till she lit a lamp and put on a dress. Her children awoke and began to cry. There were by this time 50 men and women gathered around the house. In a few minutes, Annie threw open the door with a lighted lamp in her hand. When she found out from Mr. Hadley that she was suspected of kidnapping Mandy Lou, she cried out, "Oh, Lordy, me, a voodoo witch, and wanting that child? I have 4 of my own now, and I know how to get more if I want 'em. I have a plenty now to support. Them good-for-nothing rawhiders shouldn't be allowed to have chillin'. They don't take care of them nohow. Come in, Mr. Hadley, and you too, Mr. Jimmy, but you no accounts can all stay out." There being only one large room, we soon satisfied everyone that Mandy Lou was not there. Annie said she had seen the child just shortly before sundown, playing with some burros in front of the restaurant. One of the children put in, "Yes, Mama, and I saw Mandy Lou pulling on a burro's tail." We all left shortly afterward, Mr. Hadley placing 2 men with rifles to guard Annie and her children until daylight. Everyone now felt certain that Mandy Lou would be found with the burros. As long as it was past midnight, everyone went home to bed except the rawhiders. They returned to the restaurant and kept up a droning chant until daybreak. These people had no religion, but now and then one of them learned a few verses or parables from the Bible, which he recited every chance he got, the present crisis being one. Mr. Hadley had supplied 2 of their best trailers with horses and field glasses, and at daybreak the search was on again. When my partner and myself heard the trailers leaving the salon, after getting a drink to warm them up for the trip, we dressed and struck out for the gulch. We saw some trailers bear off from the peak of Sierra Sombrero. At sunrise, we found the spot in the arroyo where the burros had bedded down. Looking closely, we also found the baby's footprints. A careful study of the tracks made it plain how Mandy Lou had spent her night. It seemed the animals had bedded down, and the child also lay down about 30 feet up the arroyo. It appears that the herd startled in the night and turned back and hustled the child along with them. After that, there were many signs of battle. The wolf tracks were mixed in with those of the burros. The two big jacks must have done considerable kicking and biting, for at every place where a circle had been formed by the burros, with the child and the colts and the jennies in the center, we found blood and hair and bits of flesh. Following the burros' trail, we soon came out on the mesa. It was plain the burros had headed for the high peak. We had hardly come to this conclusion when we heard two shots from that direction, and all at once the two trailers appeared on the ridge where the wolves had apparently made a last effort to get the child. From there, Stray Jack left bloody tracks and signs of limping. When we looked up from the tracks, we saw two wolves on the crest of a distant ridge, one of them limping badly. The burros were following the trailers. They were still uneasy and kept looking toward the ridge where the wolves had disappeared. The trailers were soon sighted by other searchers who ran to meet them. Annabelle was quirting and spurring a borrowed horse and could not get to them fast enough. Grabbing the child from the trailer, she hugged and kissed her as if she had always been the best mother in the world to her. Poor Mandy Lou was at last getting a little of the love she had so long been denied. When she could get her breath, she lisped, "Oh, Mama, Mama, the big black dog's no good. They try to get baby all the time. Big Jack, good burro. He bite and kick. Big dog's afraid. Burros run around me all the time. Oh, mama, mama, me afraid. No sleep at night. Burros make me walk." With that, she fell asleep on her mother's shoulders. Mandy Lou's baby words filled out the story written on 5 miles of bloody track. The wolves had helped the burros to save Mandy Lou's life. For it had been a night of bitter frost, and if the frightened burros had not kept her moving, she would surely have died of exposure. The burros followed the crowd almost all the way to town, and at once, as if knowing their little charge was at last safe, they turned and raced toward the peak. That afternoon, the Rawhide men took their hounds to the ridge where the wolves were last seen, and they came back shortly before sundown with 2 scalps. The first wolf they shot was already badly crippled, and his pelt was no good. The second was torn by the dogs, but not before the wolf had killed 2 of them and wounded 4. As the state paid a bounty of $20 each, the Rawhiders were in high feather. Making the most of the general good humor, the border sold out, and this closed the restaurant. A big gab fest was held among the outfit, and the celebration lasted for a week. Mandy Lou was an important little somebody for a few days. But before long, she was once more growing up with less care than a burro's colt. It was the Rawhide way.
So I'm not much of a really good reader, but I do think that it's important to go through all of your old locally published books and find all the references to the things that you're dealing with. This book alone can teach us a whole lot about our history in New Mexico in the past. For one thing, there appeared to be a lot of cattle in old-time New Mexico, whether they belong to anyone or not. If you read other books, you'll see that the Apaches brought a lot of cattle from Mexico. And it's pretty clear that the cattle were fed on by the few wolf packs we did have. Nowhere in any of the old writings have we seen more than 1 or 2 wolves at a time, and yet now they want to put hundreds and hundreds of them on the ground. Poor Mandy Lou, at least she didn't get to suffer the same fate a lot of our cattle are. And it's a really interesting story, so I hope you all enjoyed it. I'm sorry I'm not a better reader, but it is what it is. For content, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and any other podcast player that you might like best. So you can also find us at wildcattrails@gmail.com. Suggest a show or just send us a message. Give us a rating on Apple Podcasts if you would. Thanks a bunch. Thanks for listening, and be sure to share this podcast. Across the country, and shares are rising on the stock exchange. People are making hay while the sun shines. Cause bad times are coming around again. Bad times are coming around. Bad times.
Yeah.